The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
It's become the fastest and surest way to get from here to eternity. Somebody is playing the railroads like a giant train set.
Remo, I have an assignment for you.
What's that?
These train derailments. It's time we looked into them.
What are we looking for?
I suspect sabotage.
Remo Williams and Master Chun ride the rails, posing as investigators for the Department of Transportation.
Damn. Looks like something lopped the engineer's head clean off.
A katana did this.
Huh? What's a tanaka?
A katana. A sword.
What sword?
The sword of a samurai.
And could the repeated sightings of a ghostly samurai swordsman be fact or mass hysteria?
Everything okay here, Jacobs?
Yes, sir. Did we hit him?
I wish we had. We may have a ninja on board.
Like in the movies? Oh, God.
But of all the trains a ghostly samurai could choose to infiltrate, he couldn't have picked one with a more dangerous profile. For the rail-launched MX missile program, a relic of the Cold War, was never scrapped after all.
What the hell is that sticking up out of that there high cube?
Nothing.
It's a powerful big length of nothing to be nothing.
Who fired that?
Oh dear God, we have launch.
And when Chun finally comes face to face with the ghostly samurai, will an ancestral blood feud be the master of Shenanju's undoing?
Nihonjin!
Shosenjin!
Never. Impossible.
The Destroyer, number 103. Engines of Destruction.
Graphic Audio presents a breathtaking new adventure series, packed with non-stop action and intrigue, celebrating the exploits of an unforgettable protagonist, archaeologist and explorer, Anya Creed. Rogue Angel by Alex Archer.
An ancient order tied to the Vatican. A blood fortune buried in the caves of France. A conspiracy of power, greed, and darkest evil. Anya Creed's fascination with the myths and mysteries of the past leads her to a crypt in the caves of France, where the terrifying legend of the Beast of Gévaudan hints at the unimaginable. What she discovers is shattering. An artifact that will seal her destiny. A brotherhood of monks willing to murder to protect their secret. And a powerful black market occultist, desperate to put his own claim to centuries-old blood money. Anya embarks on a high-tension race across Europe and history itself, intent on linking the unholy treachery of the ages with the staggering revelations of the present. But in order to survive, she must deal with the shadowy figures, determined to silence her threat to their very existence. Rogue Angel. Destiny.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio.
A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Song of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, Michael Glenn, James Lewis, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Kate Torrey, Michael Replogle, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, and Christopher Graybill.
Henry McCarty, known locally as Kid Antrim, looked over his cards and smiled. Though his stated age was 17, the grin, along with his wispy brown hair, short stature, and baby soft skin, made him look no more than 14.
You gonna fold them worthless cards or bet, Windy?
Frank P. Windy Cahill glared at the kid.
I think you're bluffing, runt.
He watched carefully to see what effect his words would have on the younger man. The kid grinned. Even though he was furious inside at the insult, he hid his killing rage behind a smiling facade. Men were gonna die with that smile being the last thing they saw.
I can see why you're such a good blacksmith, Windy. You're damn near as big as a horseshoe shoe and twice as fat.
The kid leaned forward and pointed his finger at the pile of money in the middle of the table.
Now you can call me names all night, but that don't matter. What matters is, are you gonna call my bet or fold?
Call.
Cahill threw a $20 double eagle gold coin onto the stack of money. He spread his cards.
Two pairs, aces over queens. Read 'em and weep, kid.
Ooh, that's a mighty good hand, Windy. But not good enough to win. I got three deuces. Now, deuces are a lot like me. They ain't exactly big, but they sure do get the job done.
Miles Leslie Wood, proprietor of the local hotel where the kid usually ate his meals, sat across the table in a chair next to Cahill. He frowned and stubbed out his cigar.
Cut the crap, kid, and deal.
And the way you've been losing tonight, Miles, I'd have thought you'd want me to deal slower. That way you might be able to stay in the game for a mite longer.
Damn, but you got a smart mouth on you, kid. Maybe somebody ought to shut it for you.
The kid never looked up. His lips curled in a smile that didn't reach his cold blue eyes. Windy Cahill leapt up and literally onto the table, separating him from the kid. Kid Antrim scrambled back just in time to avoid being crushed by the table as it collapsed under the weight. Mabel Atkins, proprietor of the Atkins Dance Hall where the poker game was being held, came from her usual place at the end of the bar and stood, hands on her hips.
Kid, you better get the hell out of here before Windy gets to his feet. He's liable to kill you.
Antrim stooped to pick up his money.
He ain't gonna kill nobody. He's just full of hot air, that's why we call him Windy. Night, Mabel. I'll see you next Saturday, maybe escort you around the dance floor a time or two.
Okay, kid. Now you get on out of here while you can still walk.
The kid sauntered out the door of the dance hall. He started across the dirt road that served as Main Street in Benito.
Kid, look out!
Kid turned just in time to be barreled over by 250 pounds of furious blacksmith. Cahill grabbed him in a bear hug and threw him to the ground.
Gonna kill you, you little pimp!
I ain't no pimp, you son of a bitch!
The kid headbutted Cahill in the nose, breaking it and spreading it all over the huge man's face. It came to a rest with Cahill on top. With blood streaming from his ruined nose, he wrapped his large hands around the kid's throat and began to squeeze. The kid's vision began to blur, and dark spots swam before his eyes. He knew the man was gonna kill him. He flailed futilely at Cahill's face, but his strength was failing, and his blows had no effect. As he tried to push him away, his right hand fell on Cahill's Colt pistol. Cahill had taken the shot in the gut, blown backwards to land, sprawled, spread-eagled on his back, grasping his stomach. The kid rolled to his knees. He silently vowed never again to be caught without a pistol on his hip. When Cahill died the next morning, Miles Wood, local justice of the peace as well as hotel proprietor, conducted a coroner's inquest into the killing. A.M. Gus Gildea, a civilian scout at Camp Grant and a friend of Kid Antrim, was called as a witness to the fight. On the stand, the rail-thin cowboy turned his weather-beaten face to the jury of townspeople.
There ain't no doubt in the matter. The boy Plum didn't have no choice. He had to use his equalizer.
But isn't it true, Mr. Gildea, that the kid didn't want Mr. Cahill? That he just pulled the pistol and shot him without giving him a chance?
Gildea, who had been one of the participants in the poker game, narrowed his eyes at Wood.
That's not the way it happened, and you know it, Miles. You're just sore because the kid took all your money.
Objection. Not relevant testimony. Did the kid warn Cahill before shooting him down in cold blood or not?
No, you damn fool. The kid couldn't say nothing, because Cahill had him by the throat.
Gentlemen of the jury, you have heard how a routine bar fight ended with the death of an honest citizen of our town. How do you find?
The six men in two rows at the side of the room leaned their heads together for a moment. Finally, they all nodded and one stood up.
We find that the killing was criminal and unjustifiable, and that Henry Antrim, alias the Kid, is guilty thereof.
The next morning, while the kid was eating breakfast in his hotel, Wood walked up to his table.
I got to take you in, kid. Jury found you guilty of murder. You're under arrest.
I never figured you for such a sore loser, Miles.
The kid offered no resistance as Wood escorted him across Aravaipa Creek to the post guard house at Camp Grant, where he was incarcerated. 2 nights later, Captain G.C. Smith hosted a dinner in his quarters.
Lieutenant Cheever, find out what's going on out there. Report back immediately.
Cheever returned 5 minutes later and snapped off a smart salute.
Sir, the shots you heard were fired by the sentry at the guardhouse at a man who escaped.
Who was it, soldier?
I believe it was Kit Antrim, sir.
How could this happen, Cheever?
The sentry thinks one of the soldiers on the base aided the prisoner, sir.
Well, look into it, but keep it quiet. I don't want anyone else to know he had help, especially from a soldier under my command, understand?
Yes, sir.
Yeah!
Kid Antrim had seized the fastest horse he could find. About a week later, the pony was returned by a traveler who told Murphy that the kid asked him to return the animal to its rightful owner. The kid made his way from Silver City to Mesilla, New Mexico, then joined up with a young man his age named Tom O'Keefe. They rode through the Oregon Mountains and across the Tularosa Basin, then tried to cross the Guadalupe Mountains. On the second day of their trip through the mountains, they were climbing an Indian trail when O'Keefe suddenly reined in.
Hey, kid, look. There's a pool down there. I don't know about you, but I'm might near out of water.
Yeah, me too. I'll climb down there and get us filled up. You stay here with the horses.
The kid took both canteens and climbed down the rocky, steep cliff wall to the water. He filled them and set on back up the hill.
God damn!
He recalled stories he had heard about travelers being attacked by bands of renegade Apaches. Taking cover behind rocks and brush, the kid made his way back up to where he had left O'Keefe and the horses. There was no sign of O'Keefe, or the horses, or the bedrolls, or rations. It took Antrim 2 days to reach a barren ranch with a wind and sun-bleached cabin and barn. A hand-lettered sign at the front gate read, Jones. High school Jones, his wife Barbara, and their 10 children lived there. Barbara, known locally as Ma'am Jones, heard the kid outside and found him staggering up to their cabin.
Oh, my Lord! sword!
She grabbed him just before he fell and half carried him into the kitchen. She removed his boots, finding he wore no socks and his feet were raw and swollen.
How long's it been since you ate, boy?
More than 3 days, ma'am.
Mrs. Jones heated some milk on the wood-burning stove and took it over to where the boy sat hunched under a blanket with his feet in hot water.
I don't like milk.
Drink it. Later you may have some food, but not now. It's bad for you to eat before you've rested a little. Do you want me to hold your nose and pour it down you? That's more like it. Now I'm going to put you to bed. You're worn out and need sleep.
I can sleep right here.
You can sleep better in a bed.
The next day, the kid introduced himself as Billy Bonney, hoping to protect the Jones family from any reprisals for harboring a fugitive. When the kid was sufficiently recovered, John lent him a horse. He was again on his way, heading toward John Chisholm's South Spring River Ranch in Lincoln County, New Mexico, where he'd been told he might hire on as a range cowboy. At the time, no one in the Jones family could have guessed Billy Bonney would become a central figure in the territory's deadliest range war. Falcon McAllister reined his horse Diablo to a halt a few hundred yards from the Chisholm Ranch House. It was an impressive edifice, the size of a small fort and made of native stone from the area, with very little wood showing. It was necessary, considering Chisholm pried the land from the Mescalero Apaches. Crossing his leg over his saddle horn, he mentally reviewed what his father had told him about Chisholm. In 1868, John S. Chisholm established himself at Bosque Grande in Lincoln County, New Mexico. He brought a herd of cattle with him. Never once short on courage, Chisholm claimed 200 miles up and down the Pecos Valley, calling it his by right of discovery. The land had not yet been open to settlers, and so Chisholm squatted on it and made good his claims by his own means. La Placita del Rio Bonito was soon Americanized and designated the county seat. Chisholm himself, however many armed men might ride for him, never carried a gun. He claimed a six-shooter would get you into more trouble than it would get you out of. He quickly became the most powerful man in Lincoln County. Before his death the previous year, Jamie Ian McAllister had told Falcon if he was ever in this area to look Chisholm up. They were old friends. Falcon spurred Diablo toward the ranch house. As he rode, he kept his hands out in plain sight. He stood well over 6 feet in height, had wheat-colored blonde hair and cold, pale blue eyes. His shoulders were so wide and his muscles so developed that his typical attire, black suits with crisp ironed white shirts and black silk kerchiefs around his neck, all had to be specially tailored to fit his massive frame. On his hips, tied down low, were a matched pair of Colt Peacemaker 45s, and behind his belt buckle was a two-shot Derringer. A 44-40 caliber Winchester rifle was slung in a saddle boot within easy reach. As he approached the ranch house, Falcon noted several cowboys in the area. The men all seemed to be heavily armed, with most carrying rifles or shotguns in addition to pistols on their hips. They looked like they were ready to go to war, although most of the Indians around those parts had been run off years ago. A tall, lanky man with mean-looking eyes stepped off the porch and shucked a shell into the chamber of his Henry.
Howdy, mister. What can I do for you?
Falcon kept his hands on his reins.
I'm Falcon McAllister. I'm here to see John Chisholm.
Yeah? What's your business with Mr. Chisholm?
No business. I just came to give him my regards. He and my father used to ride together.
Your father's name?
Jamie Ian McAllister.
Wait right here.
Is it all right if I water my horse? We've been on the trail for some time, and he's mighty thirsty.
The man nodded and pointed to a horse trough next to the porch before disappearing into the house. Falcon dismounted and walked his horse to the trough. While Diablo drank his fill, Falcon dipped his hands in the water and washed some of the trail dust off his face and hair. The door opened, and one of the brawniest men he had ever seen stepped out on the porch. He smiled and held out his hand.
Howdy, Falcon. I'm John Chisholm, and I'm pleased to meet you.
Chisholm was a big man, standing over 6 feet tall. His chest and shoulders were wide as an axe handle, and there was no fat on his whole body. He sported a large handlebar mustache and mutton-chop sideburns, and his face was dark and wrinkled as saddle leather.
Come on in and lighten set and let's talk.
He led Falcon into the house, which was wide and open with lots of windows to let in the sun. Chisholm's study walls were covered with dark wood paneling, and there were several filled bookcases and 3 gun cases with rifles, shotguns, and pistols arranged within. Chisholm waved Falcon to an overstuffed chair in front of a massive desk.
Bourbon okay?
That'll do just fine.
Chisholm handed him a glass and held his up.
Here's to Jamie Ian McAllister, the best man I ever rode with.
Falcon nodded and drank to his father. Chisholm sat behind his desk and leaned forward on his elbows.
How is Jamie nowadays? I haven't heard from that old beaver in, it must be 10 years or more.
My father's dead, Mr. Chisholm.
Ah, I'm sorry to hear that, Falcon. Please, call me John. What happened?
He was backshot. Ambushed by someone who thought he was me.
Chisholm frowned. Backshooting was about the lowest crime a man could commit in the West.
Why were the men after you, Falcon? You on the run from the law?
No, but it's a long story.
Chisholm took a pair of long black cigars from a humidor on his desk and handed one to Falcon. After he lit them both, he took a sip of his bourbon and leaned back and put his boots on the desk.
I got time if you do, son.
Falcon recounted the story of his run-in with the corrupt Sheriff Noonan, his father's subsequent murder, and his encounter with Nance Noonan and his family that led to the man's descent into madness. John Chisholm took a final drag on a cigar and stared at Falcon through the cloud of smoke. After a moment, he leaned forward and stubbed the butt out in a silver dish.
That's a hell of a story, Falcon. I just can't believe old Jamie was backshot by those murdering cowards like that.
You believe it, John.
Chisholm stood and filled Falcon's empty glass and offered him another cigar.
Well, thanks. By the way, John, my father told me you had settled up here on the Pecos, but he never told me any details. How the hell did you get up here from Texas?
That's a hell of a story in its own right. Back in, 67, I think it was, my brother Pitzer and I brought my first herd of Jingle Bob cattle across the plains and through the buffalo hunting territory of the Comanches. They were some pretty hostile Injuns, let me tell you. And they could ride horses like no one I ever seen.
Yeah, I've had some dealings with them myself. My father always said they were the best warriors ever born.
We lost some good boys on that first trip. We had to send scout riders ahead of the trailblazers to protect the herd from those devils, who were pretty numerous in the lower Pecos Valley at the time. More often than not, the scouts didn't come back, or came back so shot up they couldn't work no more.
Scouting is tough work, all right, especially in Indian territory. Takes a special breed of man to do it and survive.
Well, the Jingle Bobs finally got here safely, and we put them to grazing on the lands around our headquarters, which we set up at Bosque Grande, about 35 miles northeast of Roswell, down on the Pecos itself. After a while, I left Pitzer in charge and made some more trips back to Texas for more cattle.
How many head you running now?
Oh, about 100,000 or so. Took us almost 10 years to build up to that, because of the Comanche. They finally died out or left after the buffalo were all killed. Sometime around 77 or 78.
You ever married, John?
Nope. Never felt no need, with all my brothers and their wives and children around all the time. But enough about me. What are you doing out here?
When I set out to right the wrong done to my father, my kids went back east so they could get proper schooling. So I'm kinda at loose ends right now.
Anything I can do? You need a job? Money?
No. Pa left all of us kids more money than we can ever spend.
I was thinking more along the lines of investing in a saloon or a gambling house. You know of any that might suit my needs?
You know, old Beaver Smith owns a saloon on the Pecos River over at Fort Sumner. He might be willing to sell or take in a partner.
I'm not much one for partnering. But I'll sure go take a look at the place and see what I think.
Falcon stood and held out his hand.
Thanks for the whiskey and the talk, John. I can see why my dad thought so much of you.
Anytime, Falcon. I'll tell the boys you're my friend, and you're always welcome here at South Spring. That way they won't hassle you when you come to visit. Well, I'll be jiggered. Looks like I got more company coming.
Falcon turned to see a lone rider walking his horse up the dirt road toward the ranch house. The rider was a short man wearing a dirty black coat over a soiled and rumpled shirt that Falcon thought must have once been white. As the rider drew closer, Falcon turned to Chisholm.
Hell, John, he looks like a kid on that horse. You taking to hiring boys now?
Things aren't that bad yet, Falcon.
The rider looked at the hard cases standing in front of the house with their rifles trained on him. He removed his hat, running his hands through light brown hair. His eyes crinkled as he smiled at Falcon and Chisholm on the porch.
One of you, Mr. John Chisholm?
Yeah, that's me. What can I do you for, young man?
My name's Billy Bonney. I heard you was looking to hire some men. Men who know their way around a six-shooter.
Falcon noticed that though the lips smiled and the eyes narrowed in apparent good humor, there was something deep in the eyes that belied the grin. As they flicked back and forth, sizing up the men with guns in the area, it was obvious they missed nothing. Falcon knew this was no mere boy, but a deadly man to be reckoned with.
And you think that would be you, is that it?
Yes, sir!
With a minimum of motion, Bonney slowly pulled his coat back and tucked it in his belt behind his back, letting his hands hang loose by his side.
If you have any doubts in the matter, I'd be right happy to show you with any of these galoots standing here.
Mac Monroe, one of the toughest-looking hombres in the group of men, stepped forward. He was about 5'11" tall and must have weighed almost 250 pounds. He stood in front of Bonney with his hands on his hips.
Well, I'm Mac Monroe, foreman of this here spread, and you can show me how good you are if you got the goods. Now, you want I should throw this pup in the trough, boss?
Bonnie's eyes slowly looked Monroe up and down, then cut to Chisholm.
If I kill this man, can I have his job, Mr. Chisholm?
His face showed no fear. Chisholm rubbed his mustache, his own lips curled up in mirth at the cojones this boy was showing. He'd seen few men have the courage to face Monroe, with fists or with guns.
No, I'll have none of that, Mr. Bonney. If you kill him, I'll still be a man short, even if I hire you.
Chisholm walked to the porch rail and took a tin coffee mug and pitched it to one of the other hands.
Bob, on the count of three, throw this mug in the air. Monroe, you and Bonney can both draw on it, and we'll see if this kid has what it takes.
Falcon stood on the porch watching Bonney out of the corner of his eye and saw the young man's lips curl up into a sly smile at the mention of a shooting contest.
How good is Monroe, John?
He's the best I got with a short gun, Falcon. Why?
I've got $100 says the kid takes him. Are you on?
Do you know this man, Falcon?
I've never seen him before in my life.
Then why on earth would you risk $100 on him?
Well, first of all, I'm a gambler for a living and for fun. And second, you look in his eyes and you tell me what you see.
Chisholm turned to stare for a moment at Bonney, and Falcon noticed the big man's smile falter. He was seeing the same thing Falcon was.
Damn if you're not right, Falcon. No bet.
I'll take your bet, mister.
You got $100, cowboy?
I ain't gonna need it, because I'm gonna beat this pup. But I've got a hand-tooled Mexican saddle that ought to go for about that.
You're on.
The cowboys gathered around the two men after Bonney stepped down from his horse. There was almost nothing punchers liked more than a contest. Several of the men were making small side bets, looking nervously at Monroe as if they didn't want to get caught betting against their foreman.
One, two, three.
Bob threw the cup in the air. Bonnie's hand flashed upward with his Colt and fired almost without aiming before Monroe had even cleared the leather. Hit squarely, the cup spun off on a tangent. It reached its apex and began to fall. Cup danced in the air once again.
God damn, he hit it again whilst it was still in the air.
Monroe blushed a deep red, standing there with his pistol still half in his holster. He stared at Bonnie, eyes hard and face set. Bonnie had sense enough not to gloat. He held out his hand to Monroe.
Don't take it to heart, Mr. Monroe. You and I both know shooting at something that don't shoot back is easy. Things might be a bit different if we had been facing another gun slick.
Monroe took his hand.
You all right, Bonnie. And one of the best shootists I ever seen. I'd be right proud to have you stand with me if it ever came to gunplay.
There's more to this boy than meets the eye, John. He's deep as well water and damn near as cold.
Monroe stepped over to the porch and looked up at Falcon.
I'll just go get my saddle, mister, and I'll bring it right over.
I don't need another saddle, Mr. Monroe. But I'm going to be buying a gambling establishment in the near future. I'll call our bet even if you bring some of your friends in for the grand opening.
It's a deal. You just let me know when and where.
Chisholm motioned Bonnie to join him and Falcon on the porch.
Mr. Bonnie, I don't really need any more hands, but I got a good friend who does, especially one as good with the pistol as you are.
Who might that be, Mr. Chisholm?
His name's John Tunstall. He's not much older than you, about 24, I suspect. But he and I are going into business together, and I know he'll need some extra man.
How'll I find him?
You head on into Lincoln and go to the building marked Tunstall's General Store. I reckon he'll be there about now. Tell him I sent you.
Thanks, Mr. Chisholm. I appreciate the help.
Hold on there, Bonnie. Give me a minute and I'll ride into Lincoln with you. If you want some company, that is.
Sure. Always nice to have somebody to talk to on a trail.
You're a pretty fair hand with that shotgun, Billy. Where'd you learn to shoot like that?
You can call me Kid, Falcon. Everybody else does. I learned to shoot because I had to. I've been on my own since I was 14 or so. Hell, I worked sheep and cattle in Arizona. Was even a teamster for a while over at Camp Grant. You don't long survive doing that kind of work less than you can shoot. Fast and straight.
Before Falcon could answer the kid, his horse Diablo laid his ears back. Falcon stiffened. Something was wrong. He casually reached down and slipped the rawhide hammer thongs off his colts.
You see something?
I think we may have some trouble up ahead, where the trail turns around that clump of mesquite trees.
Kid hooked his coat in his belt and slipped his hammer thongs off.
Well, if they's thieves, they're gonna be mighty disappointed. I ain't got two coins to rub together.
As the pair approached the copse of trees, four riders walked their horses out of hiding and blocked the trail. The leader of the group, a tall, skinny man with chin whiskers and a scar on his left cheek, held a short, double-barreled shotgun pointed at the sky with its stock on his thigh.
You gents work for Chisholm?
What business is it of yours who we work for?
We're deputy sheriffs, working for the sheriff of Lincoln County, William Brady.
Now don't answer the man's question.
We've been having some reports that other people's stock has been turning up in Chisholm's herd. You boys know anything about that?
I don't reckon Mr. Chisholm would much appreciate being called a rustler, but I could be wrong. Why don't you men ride up to his ranch and ask him?
'Cause we're asking you, gents. Now, you tell us what you know, or we'll be forced to arrest you, and you can spend some time in jail thinking over your answers.
I don't think I'd like that. And I don't think you're man enough to take me anywheres.
Why, you little...
Before he got his pistol halfway out of his holster, the kid drew and fired. As the leader started to lower his shotgun and the other two riders reached for their pistols, they found themselves staring down the barrel of both of Falcon's Colt's hammers back.
Easy, boys. Just put those weapons back where they came from and raise your hands.
The men's eyes grew wide at the speed with which Billy and Falcon had drawn.
Just keep them fingers off the triggers. You don't want to go shooting no officers of the law.
We didn't want to shoot nobody till that tub of lard over there tried to draw on me. Now we're going to ride on into Lincoln. Now if you galoots want to dance some more, you know where to find us.
Falcon and the kid holstered their weapons and rode on toward town, leaving the deputies to patch up the wounded man's arm.
What's the matter, Falcon? You mad about something?
We could have avoided gunplay back there, kid.
Yeah, I suppose we could have let them take us into town and stick us in that jail until the sheriff decided he wanted to talk to us.
It wouldn't have gone that far.
Damn right it wouldn't have. I tell you, Falcon, I've been in jail. Twice. And I broke out. Twice. I can't stand being locked up. No, sir, I don't ever intend for that to happen again. And if and I have to kill somebody to keep from being locked up, then so be it.
Falcon watched the kid as he talked, thinking he was right about the kid's eyes. He would have to watch himself so he wouldn't get caught up in the kid's messes. Falcon and the kid arrived in Lincoln about an hour later. The town wasn't overly large, consisting of a row of small adobe houses on the west side of the main street and several larger, more impressive buildings lined up on the eastern side. The first of the large buildings on their left had a sign over the door saying La Placita, J.J. Dolan and Company. It was two stories high and had a large window in the front filled with all manner of ranching implements, along with saddles and boots and clothes.
Damn! That's about the biggest general store I ever seen.
Falcon glanced at the place as they passed it, thinking the kid was right. The next building they came to was the county courthouse. Since Lincoln was the county seat, it was also large and impressive. Right next to it was the bank, with a sign over it saying, Lincoln County Bank, J.J. Dolan, President. Falcon looked farther up the street, wondering if there were any saloons. Chisholm has said most of the men in the surrounding area went over to Fort Sumner to gamble. The upstanding citizens of Lincoln were not allowing any gaming houses in their city. All in all, the city looked not much different to Falcon than dozens of others he had seen. It was a more or less typical cow town which served the purpose of supplying surrounding ranches, as well as giving the punchers a place to let off some steam.
I'm so hungry my belly must think my throat's been cut.
Me too. But say we pull up to the hotel over there and see if they've got any chow worth eating.
No, I think I'll just grab me some water over at the town well and see if I can find out which direction Tunstall's ranch is from here.
Kid, it looks like we're both going to be here for a spell. How about I treat you to some grub, and you can pay me back from your first month's wages?
I never did much like being beholden to anybody. I can make my own way.
As they came up on the hotel, the smell of enchiladas, beans, and rice cooking tickled their noses.
Come on, kid. I'm flush right now. And like I said, you can pay me back later.
Well, all right. But I'm going to give you my marker so there won't be no mistake about there being a handout or anything.
Have it your way, kid, but hurry up. My stomach's beginning to growl at the smell of that food.
In the hotel's main dining room, there were six tables spread out across the room, four of them full of cowboys with heads bent over plates, shoveling in food and washing it down with pitchers of beer. Falcon and the kid took a corner table and sat with their backs to the wall where they could see the entrance to the room. A heavy-set Mexican woman wearing a bright red apron walked over to their table.
What would you gentlemen like?
Bring us a couple of steaks, charred on the outside and bloody in the middle. A plate of enchiladas, some beans and rice, and a handful of tortillas. Is that all right with you, kid?
Yeah.
And a pitcher of some beer if it's cold.
We no serve it no other way, senor.
You got any lemonade? I don't hardly ever drink alcohol.
Si, senor.
A few minutes later, a young black teenager brought a pitcher of beer for Falcon and lemonade for the kid and two glass mugs to their table.
To a new start in a new town, Falcon.
The beer was cold and tasted good after their hours on the trail.
You don't like beer?
It's not that so much, Falcon. It's just that I never seen it do no man any good. Most of them get a snootful of that stuff and they think they're right handy with a gun. Usually, just gets them killed.
I hope you're able to settle down here, kid. Seems a good town to make a new start in.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm tired of moving from place to place. I've been on the go since I was a pup. It's time I settle down and pick me a spot to take root.
The waitress returned with a large tray covered with plates of steaming food, which she set down on the table.
Time to quit jawing and start eating.
As they ate, Falcon let his gaze wander around the room, watching the other cowboys at the surrounding tables. At a table in a far corner, there were four men eating and drinking. One of the men was tall, with wide shoulders and a barrel chest. He was wearing a black leather vest with a silver star on his right breast. And his eyes were Star Packer's eyes, never still, flitting back and forth around the room as if looking for trouble. His eyes met Falcon's, and he noticed Falcon watching him. As Falcon watched, the Star Packer nudged the lanky, gangling man next to him and nodded in Falcon's direction. Falcon broke eye contact and finished eating. He knew the wanted posters on him had been recalled after his brother had talked to the governor, so he was no longer a fugitive from the law. But still, some sheriffs took instant dislike to strangers. As Falcon took his last bite of steak and drained his beer glass, the door to the dining room burst open. Two men came running into the room. It was a tall, skinny galoot with the chin whiskers and scar on his face, one of the four who had braced Falcon and the kid on the trail into town. He and his companion went straight to the table where the lawman sat. Falcon nudged the kid with his elbow and inclined his head toward the group across the room.
We may have some trouble, kid.
The kid looked up from the last of his beans, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and reached down to loosen the hammer thongs on his colt.
Ooh, easy, cowboy. Remember, you're here to make a new start. Getting into a shooting match with a sheriff is not a good way to begin your stay here.
I'm not planning nothing, Falcon. It don't hurt none to be ready, just in case.
The man with the star nodded in their direction. The two new arrivals turned to stare at Falcon and the kid. Star Packer pursed his lips, then got to his feet, hitching up his gun belt and getting his hat from a nearby hat rack. He ambled across the room, followed by the six men with him.
Howdy, gents.
Falcon pushed his chair back, leaned back, and extended his right leg with his right hand on his thigh near his colt in case the sheriff gave him no choice.
Morning, Sheriff.
The kid said nothing, but Falcon noticed he shifted in his chair so his pistol was within ready reach should the need arise.
My name's Sheriff William Brady. My men tell me you drew down on them and shot one of my deputies.
Then your men are liars, Sheriff.
Scarface blanched at the insult, his hand falling toward his pistol as he leaned forward. Falcon didn't move.
Your men drew on my friend and me first, Sheriff, for no reason. And if you don't control that one there, he'll be the next one lying on his back with a bullet in his chest.
He inclined his head toward Scarface. Brady's eyes narrowed as he studied Falcon and noticed the way his colts were tied down low and the way his hands were quiet, with no signs of nerves at facing seven men to their two. He chewed on his lip, considering his options.
Well, whatever the cause, I don't take kindly to strangers shooting up my men.
I don't take kindly to tin-horn deputies trying to throw their weight around by hassling law-abiding citizens who aren't breaking any laws, Sheriff. Last time I looked, it was still legal to ride down a trail minding your own business.
They was coming for Chisholm's, Will.
That true, mister?
Yep. My father was an old friend of Mr. Chisholm's, and I stopped by to give him my regards on my way to Fort Sumner.
Then you don't work for him?
Nope.
How about you, boy?
Not me neither.
That's the one shot Johnny Roy.
That so, boy?
The kid leaned back in his chair, his hand near his pistol.
If Johnny Roy is the name of the fat tub of lard who tried to draw on me, then I'm the one that shot him.
What's your name, son?
My name's Billy Bonney, Sheriff, but I go by Kid.
How about you, mister?
My name is Falcon McAllister, Sheriff, and the kid is right. As I said earlier, your man drew on us without provocation or cause, and we acted in self-defense.
If Johnny drew first, how'd you manage to put lead in him? He's pretty quick.
Huh, quick? That man was slow as molasses.
Johnny never even cleared leather, Will. He never had a chance.
Kid glanced at where Scarface held his hand on the butt of his pistol.
Neither will you if you try to pull that hog leg. I'll drop you where you stand.
That's mighty tough talk for someone outnumbered 3-1, boy.
Kid smirked and started to stand up, but Falcon put a hand on his arm.
Sheriff, have we broken any laws?
I don't suppose so. Not if the shooting went as you say it did.
Then I suggest you question all your men about the events on the trail before we start something here that might get someone else hurt.
I'll do that, Mr. McAllister. And I'll also take a look at my posters, see if there's any paper out on you boys.
As Brady walked out of the room, Falcon noticed the kid watching him with narrowed eyes and pursed lips.
You worried about what Sheriff Brady might find among those wanted posters, kid?
Not really. I done told you I was in jail a couple of times and broke out.
Of course, that was under another name, so I doubt if it matters what the sheriff does.
What name were you using then?
Henry Antrim, but I was called Kid Antrim.
Well, I hope the sheriff is as dumb as he looks and doesn't make the connection between Kid Antrim and Billy Bonney.
Falcon stood up and threw some coins down on the table.
Now let's see if we can find out where this Mr. Tunstall you're looking for lives.
The kid raised his hand, summoning their waitress.
Si, senor, may I help you?
Yeah, can you tell us where to find a Mr. John Tunstall?
Shh! Not so loud, senor. This place don't like Mr. Tunstall much. He has general store at the other end of town. You cannot miss it.
The waitress picked up Falcon's money and hurried back through the door into the kitchen, casting a worried look over her shoulder.
What do you suppose she meant by all that?
Only one way to find out, kid. Let's mosey on down the street and look for his store.
As they walked down the wooden planks of the boardwalk, Falcon watched the townspeople as they scurried about their business.
You notice anything funny about these people, kid?
No. Why you ask?
It's just a feeling I get. Seems they're all so serious, almost as if they're walking on eggshells, waiting for something to happen.
Couldn't tell it by me, Falcon. They just look like ordinary folk doing whatever it takes to get along. There it is. Tunstall's Emporium, the sign says.
Falcon noticed a pair of tough-looking gun hands hanging around the entrance to Tunstall's place. They were leaning back against the wall on either side of the door, thumbs hooked in their holsters. Though their posture was relaxed, he could see their eyes scanning the street, missing nothing.
I wonder why Tunstall feels the need to have armed guards in front of his store.
What'd you say?
Oh, nothing. Just thinking out loud.
They walked up the boardwalk and had started to enter the store when one of the gunnies grabbed the kid by the arm.
If and I was you, mister, I'd let go of my arm real gentle-like.
Falcon put a hand on the kid's Colt, pushing it down.
That's all right, kid. This man is just doing what Mr. Tunstall pays him to do. Guard his establishment.
That right, mister? You work for Tunstall?
The cowboy nodded, sweat running down his forehead to drip into his eyes, his gaze locked on the Colt in the kid's hand.
Yeah, we're supposed to keep any of Dolan's or Riley's men out of here.
Who?
Never mind, kid. I'm sure Mr. Tunstall will fill us in once we get to talk to him.
It's all right, Roy. Let the gentleman in, please.
Falcon and the kid walked into a large room filled with all manner of ranching implements, clothes, and foodstuffs. There was a counter running along one side of the wall off to the right, and in a far corner sat a large pot-bellied stove. Next to the stove was a table where four men sat drinking coffee. One of the men was young, appearing to be in his early 20s, with a fair complexion and bright green eyes, wearing a brown jacket over corduroy pants. The other men were older. One wore a suit and vest with a gold watch chain hanging across it. The other two were cowboys, wearing jeans and shirts and Stetson hats, which had seen plenty of wear. Like the two outside the door, the punchers were packing pistols tied down low on their legs. The kid walked up to the older man in the suit and stuck out his hand.
Mr. Tunstall, my name's Billy Bonahan.
The man held up his hand.
Hold on there, Slick. My name is Alexander McSween. I'm Mr. Tunstall's lawyer. There's the man you want to talk to.
He nodded to the younger man sitting next to him. Tunstall stood up and held out his hand.
Mr. Bonney, I'm John Henry Tunstall. Alex McSween is my lawyer. Dick Brewer there is foreman of my ranch. And the chap next to him is his assistant, Charlie Boder.
The kid tipped his hat.
Howdy, boys. This here is my friend Falcon McAllister.
You any relation to Jamie McAllister?
He was my father.
Was?
Yeah, he died a while back.
I'm sorry to hear that. I can't tell you how many times I've sat here next to this very stove during a Blue Norther and listened to John Chisholm tell tales of how the two of them rode together, fighting Indians, rustlers, and seems like just about everyone else in the old days.
Probably same tall stories I used to hear from my dad, and he had more than his share of adventures in his life.
Well, maybe we'll get a chance to share some stories if you plan to be around here long enough. What can I do for you, Mr. Bonney?
Well, I spoke with Mr. Chisholm, and he said maybe you could use another hand. I'm looking for work.
Tunstall glanced at the way the kid wore his pistol low on his hip.
You any good with that six-shooter?
Pretty fair. I usually hit what I'm aiming at, if that's what you mean.
You have any problem aiming it at men?
Not enough so you can tell it, Mr. Brewer. Why, that part of the job?
Well, the way things are going is more than likely. You looking for work too, Falcon?
Not at the present time. I'm on my way to Fort Sumner. I hear there's a saloon there I might be able to buy an interest in.
Oh, you mean Beaver Smith's place, the drinking hole?
Uh-huh. John Chisholm told me he might be interested in making a deal, if the price were right.
It's a prosperous establishment. Gets a lot of trade from both the soldiers stationed at the fort and from the surrounding ranches. Of course, old Beaver is getting along in years. He might be willing to take in a partner.
Dick Brewer and Charlie Boulder stood up.
Sitting here and John ain't getting those cattle took care of, Mr. Tunstall. We better get on back to the ranch.
Take Mr. Barney with you and get him some clean clothes and set him up in the bunkhouse. Show him around and fill him in on what our situation is so he'll know what we need.
Yes, sir.
The kid shook hands with Tunstall, then turned to leave.
I'll see you around, Falcon. Yeah, I like to turn a card or two on occasion, so I'll look you up at your place on my day off. I still owe you for the meal.
So long, kid. You take it easy here.
Are you in a hurry, Falcon, or have you got time for some coffee?
Always time for coffee, John.
Falcon pulled out a chair. He just couldn't bring himself to keep calling someone his own age or younger Mister anymore. McSween was a typical Western lawyer, with slicked back hair, a slight paunch that strained the front of his vest, and a weak chin and expression that told Falcon he wouldn't be a man he'd want to depend on in a fight. Tunstall, on the other hand, seemed to Falcon to have steely-eyed determination written all over him. His green eyes and fair skin and accent marked him as a man from a long way off, but he had a quiet strength, and Falcon bet he was a born leader whose men would go through fire for him if he asked.
If you don't mind my saying it, John, it appears to me you're more interested in hiring guns than punchers.
Well, yes, unfortunately, that is the case. We're on the verge of a range war here, Falcon.
Over what? There seems to be plenty of water and feeding ground to go around.
There are two Irishmen, J.J. Dolan and John Riley, who are behind most of the trouble.
Bastards!
They own the large general store at the other end of town. Used to be called La Placita before they bought it from Lawrence Murphy. And now they hold a virtual monopoly of the county's trade. In addition, they have close ties to influential territorial officials in the capital at Santa Fe, known as the Santa Fe Ring. They're bloody friends. They have given them complete control of all government contracts for supplying beef to army posts and Indian reservations.
These two must have a sizable spread to be able to sell that much beef to the government.
Not a bloody head. They buy every bit of the meat they sell from the other ranches around here at rock-bottom prices, and then sell it to their friends in Santa Fe at a huge profit, which they then spread around to buy more power in the capital.
Buy it! Hell! Get their friend Jesse Evans and his gang to steal most of it, by my reckoning.
Now, take it easy, Alex. You know we can't prove that, and besides, you know when you get angry, your asthma starts to act up?
I can see how that wouldn't make the cattlemen around here very happy.
Well, to add insult to injury, until I opened my store, they were able to charge whatever they wanted to the ranchers for their supplies. The owners weren't able to complain, or they'd be cut off from buying from La Placita. They pretty much had things their own way in Lincoln County and the surrounding Pecos Valley until I decided to make a change. John Chisholm and I saw no reason why mere merchants with little or no experience in cattle raising should have a corner on the government contracts, or why we ranchers who own vast herds should not deal directly with the government as beef suppliers. So John and I hired Alex McSween here. We organized a number of the smaller ranchers and farmers who were unable to get credit from La Placita to go up against Dolan and Riley. I opened this store and we began to try to get some of the contracts directly. John Chisholm and Alex and I also opened a bank to help our cattlemen friends who need it.
I can see where that would cause some hard feelings from the Dolan and Riley factions.
It certainly has. By spreading our own money around Santa Fe, we've been able to make some inroads into their business and have gotten a few contracts of our own. The problem is they have Lincoln pretty much sewed up and they control Sheriff Brady and his cronies, Lock, Stock, and Barrel. Falcon, it's a powder keg just waiting to explode. I'm afraid that sooner or later the whole matter will be decided by who has the greater firepower.
Well, thanks for the drink, and good luck to you and Mr. Chisholm. I know from things my father told me that he's a good man.
Tunstall rose and shook Falcon's hand.
Oh, he's one of the best, as was your father to hear him tell it. Good luck, Falcon. When you come back to Lincoln, consider my house yours for as long as you need it.
See you around, Falcon.
You can bet on it, Alex.
As Falcon walked out to his horse, he wondered just what kind of snake's nest he and the kid were getting into.
Sure as hell won't be boring around here.
When Falcon arrived in Fort Sumner, he found a cow town that was small. It served the purpose of being a watering hole for cowboys from nearby ranches and soldiers from the adjacent garrison at the fort. There were more saloons and eating establishments than houses, and few children could be seen. It was just what Falcon was looking for, a place where thirsty punchers and soldiers came to raise a little hell and spend hard-earned dollars learning the intricacies of poker and faro. He would be more than willing to teach. Though it was early in the evening, the drinking hole saloon was almost full. Along one side of the room was a long bar, backed by a 7-foot mirror and a painting of a reclining nude woman, swathed in red silk sheets that didn't manage to cover much of her body. There were several kegs of beer and a row of various brands of liquor. There were 8 tables scattered across the room, and all had poker games going. The sweating, drunken cowboys and soldiers spending in one night what it had taken them 30 days to earn. Falcon felt right at home. He walked to the bar and squeezed in between 2 punchers.
Whiskey.
He turned and leaned back against the bar as he drank, observing the room and its occupants. Picking the right game to enter was as important as drawing the right cards. He didn't play with men who looked as if they couldn't afford to lose. He wanted the kind of high-stakes game only the prosperous could give him. At one of the tables, there were 2 men who were, like Falcon, wearing suit coats and white shirts, and 2 others who were wearing denim pants and leather vests, but were too old to be punchers, probably local ranchers out to get away from their wives and children for an evening of fun and games. Falcon figured the suits were professional gamblers or merchants or bankers, men who could well afford to play his type of game. He ambled over to stand watching the play at the table he picked out.
Care to sit in, friend?
I don't mind if I do. Playing 5-card stud?
Yep. $10 ante, pot limit on bets. Too rich for your blood?
Suits me.
Falcon pulled a stack of greenbacks from his coat pocket. He kept his face straight, noticing everything that went on at the table. One of the secrets of his success as a gambler was his ability to read other players. And he knew from the start the 2 to watch out for were the men wearing suits. Though over the years, he had found that most of the really good card players acted as if they didn't know the difference between a straight and a flush.
My name's Ben Johnson. That's Johnny Albright, and those 2 are Lewis Longacre and Marcus Cahill.
I'm Falcon McAllister.
You new in town, Falcon?
Just got in today.
Are you here on business or pleasure?
Lewis ain't being nosy, Falcon. He's the town banker. He's always hoping someone will come into town and buy up some of the mortgages he's holding paper on.
As a matter of fact, it's a little of both. I'm looking to invest some money here in Fort Sumner, maybe do a little business. As to the pleasure, that depends on how the cards fall in the next few hours.
Ben, just shut up and deal the damn cards. This ain't no ladies' society social. Let's play poker!
Falcon glanced at the pile of chips and money in front of Johnny. It was considerably smaller than the others. It was always the losers who wanted to hurry the game along. It would take him a couple of hours to figure out the other players' tells, the motions and mannerisms most players make that can tell an experienced poker player how good their hand is. Soon, Falcon learned that Lewis Longacre owned the Fort Sumner Bank and was a partner of Marcus Cahill and several other businesses in town, including the hotel and the livery stable. Ben Johnson and Johnny Albright were both ranchers, as he had figured, and owned 2 of the largest spreads east of town. Of the group at the table, Lewis and Marcus were better than average players, Ben was average, and Johnny, he was terrible. Falcon played conservatively, betting only when he had a good hand, folding with anything less than a sure winner, while he learned the habits of his opponents. Ben had few tells, but tended not to push his advantage when he had good cards. He obviously played for the fun of the game. And Johnny Albright, on the other hand, did everything badly. He sweated and blinked rapidly when he tried to bluff, and became boisterous and jubilant when he had a good hand, thus letting the others know they should bail out. Falcon, for his part, played to stay about even, throwing away some winning hands just so as not to make too good an impression on the men. If he was going to be playing here for any length of time, he didn't want them to think he was a card sharp. The hardest thing about making a living at gambling was to let your opponents think you had won by luck. That way, they would keep coming back for more, hoping your luck would change. It was well after midnight when Falcon figured it was about time to call it a night. He was $250 ahead. Ben and Marcus were about even. Lewis had won over $600, most of it from Johnny Albright. Johnny didn't seem to mind overly much. Falcon noticed Marcus and Lewis glancing at each other with tiny, tight smiles on their faces, and realized this was probably a weekly occurrence. Suddenly, a man at an adjacent table jumped to his feet, clawing for his pistol.
You liar son of a bitch!
The young soldier in uniform swayed unsteadily on his feet as he aimed the Colt Army revolver at another player at his table, who sat with large eyes and raised hands.
You've been cheating me all night, Billy Bob. I'm gonna drill you for it.
In one fluid motion, Falcon stood up, drawing his Colt and bringing it down on top of the kid's head. The young man dropped like a stone, unconscious but unhurt.
God damn. Did you see that feller draw?
Shit, he moved quicker than a rattler.
Falcon bent over the soldier and checked his head to make sure he was all right.
One of you soldiers mind taking him out to base? Get a doctor to look him over?
A short, stubby man wearing a bright red plaid shirt, yellow suspenders, and sporting a full bushy beard waddled over to the table. He looked at Falcon and stuck out his hand.
Howdy, partner. I'm Beaver Smith. I own this place, and I owe you a drink for preventing that young buck from killing somebody.
Well, just let me collect my money, and I'll take you up on that drink, Mr. Smith.
Oh, hell, son, just call me Beaver. Everybody else does.
Falcon shook hands all around at his table.
Well, I enjoyed the evening, gents. I'd like to do it again sometime.
Yeah, and maybe next time you won't be so lucky with them cards, Falcon.
You're right, Johnny. I was awfully lucky tonight. Maybe next time it'll be your turn to have the luck.
Beaver Smith opened a door next to the bar and ushered Falcon into his office with a sweep of his hand. Falcon was impressed at the size and the opulence of the place. Though the saloon, like all of the other buildings in Fort Sumner, was nondescript and ordinary, Beaver's office was furnished tastefully. The entire floor was covered in a thick woven rug, and the walls had dark wood paneling. There was a couch against one side wall, a small, well-stocked bar against another, and in the rear was a large oaken desk with two heavy easy chairs arrayed in front of it.
You like my little hideaway?
It's very nice. Rather unexpected.
Yeah. When I bought the drinking hole more than 10 years ago, I decided if I was going to spend half my life running the place, I wanted to make myself a room I'd enjoy being in. Take a load off, son, and I'll get you a nip of some really fine bourbon. Brought all the way from Kentucky.
In a few moments, Smith was settled in a plush, overstuffed desk chair, watching Falcon with appraising eyes.
You don't strike me as the sort of traveling gambler we usually get around here, Falcon.
Well, that's because I'm not a gambler. At least I don't make my living at it.
Ah, man, that's smooth. Yeah, I didn't think so. Just what do you do for a living, Falcon?
Oh, I've got my hand in several ventures. I own a ranch and breed some horses. And I own a saloon in Valley, Colorado, called the Wild Rose. And I do a bit of gambling to pass the time when I'm not otherwise engaged.
So you must know what I have to put up with, running the drinking hole. Sometimes I think I'm getting a bit long in the tooth to be in this business, though. If it's not drunken cowboys shooting the place up, it's pissed off soldiers fighting and throwing chairs and breaking furniture.
Yeah, it can be rather exciting, especially late in the night when the boys have gotten a snoot full of whiskey and realize they've lost all their money for the rest of the month. It's a good brand, rich. I can almost taste the redwood barrels it's been aged in. Beaver, I'd like to make you an offer on the drinking hole.
You mean you want to buy my saloon?
If it's for sale.
Son, everything's for sale if the price is right. though I don't rightly know what I'd do with myself if I sold out. It's true, running the place gets to be a bit wearying, but I'm not the sort to go sit by a stream with a pole and fish for the rest of my life.
I realize that, and I'm not the sort of man to settle down in one town for any length of time. So how about this? I'll pay you a fair price for half ownership in the drinking hole. And for as long as I'm around, I'll run it. You can take some time off and rest up for travel or whatever you want to do. When I get tired of Fort Sumner, I'll be on my way. And you can send my half of our profits to my bank back in Valley, Colorado.
You trust me to do that, young fella?
I never enter into a business arrangement with a man I can't trust. And in all my years, I've never yet been disappointed in any of my partners.
Well, if we're going to make a deal, let's get down to some serious negotiating.
It took almost 2 more hours and the rest of the bottle of bourbon before they agreed on a price for Falcon to purchase a half interest in the drinking hole. They shook hands and Falcon prepared to return to his hotel.
I told you I was a good judge of character. If you run the saloon half as well as you bargain, our profits are assured.
The next night, after Beaver had packed up a suitcase and gone to visit his daughter over in Roswell, Falcon began his first night as new owner of the drinking hole. He arranged with the cook at the hotel to provide a large tray of sandwiches and several jars of pickled eggs, which he placed next to a sign saying, "Free food."
Why are we giving the food away for free, Mr. McAllister?
The more Puncher eats, the more he drinks. And our real profit is in the whiskey and beer we serve. Those pickled eggs make a man mighty thirsty. And the more we give away, the more whiskey we sell.
What about the sandwiches?
A man with a full stomach is less likely to get dead drunk and start a fight. Or shoot up the place. And the longer it takes a man to get drunk, the longer he can drink.
I can see things are gonna be a mite different around here.
Not too different. Beaver ran a nice place. I just want to help him out with a few minor changes to enhance our profit margin a little.
As the saloon began to fill up, Falcon went to his table. He had set up a felt-covered table in a corner away from the entrance, and he sat with his back to a wall so he could observe everything that went on. He had Roy bring him a cup of coffee, and he sat there, watching the play at the other tables and the faro game, and dealt himself a game of solitaire to play until the heavy poker players arrived. When he saw Billy Bonney and Dick Brewer, John Tunstall's foreman, walk through the door, he waved Billy over to his table. Billy left Brewer at the bar and pulled up a seat across from Falcon.
Well, howdy, kid. You like a beer?
You know I don't drink or smoke, Falcon.
Well, then, how's the new job going?
It's all right, so far. Mr. Tunstall seems a right decent man to work for.
He got you punching cows?
No, thank goodness. Dick's in charge of the cattle. My job is to stay next to Mr. Tunstall and make sure nobody shoots him in the back. Well, the boss thinks Murphy and Dolan are getting right tired of him taking their business away from him. And he says Mr. Chisholm was working on getting some of them government contracts to sell beef to the Indians. Mr. Tunstall says if that happens, the lead is liable to start flying sooner rather than later.
Well, be sure to keep a close eye on your own back while you're watching out for Tunstall's, kid.
I keep my holster greased and the hammer thong off all the time, Falcon. I'm ready for whatever these galoots want to throw my way.
What you doing out this way, kid?
I heard you bought into the saloon here, and I wanted to come and give you some business. Mr. Tunstall advanced me some pay, and it's been too long since I sat in a good poker game.
You any good at poker?
I usually win more than I lose.
Falcon glanced over the kid's shoulder and saw Ben Johnson, Johnny Albright, Lewis Longacre, and Marcus Cahill coming through the door.
You're in business, kid. Here comes some gents who'd be glad to test your luck.
Luck has very little to do with winning, Falcon. It's all in knowing who you're up against and being ready to do whatever it takes to beat them.
Gentlemen, this here is Billy Bonney, otherwise known as Kit. Kit, this is Ben Johnson, Johnny Albright, Lewis Longacre, and Marcus Cahill. You men ready to play?
Deal 'em. I feel real lucky tonight.
The kid looked over at Falcon and winked, making Falcon smile in return. In some strange way, the kid was a man after his own heart.